Here's a question that might keep you up at night, plant friend. What if your plants that are sitting on your windowsills or sitting in your front yard are doing a lot more than just sitting there and looking pretty? What if they are actually communicating? For the Best of Growing Joy series this week, I decided to bring a fascinating conversation I had a couple years ago with Paco Calvo. He's a professor and a philosopher of science, and his writing partner, science writer Natalie Lawrence. They're co-authors of a book called Planta Sapiens, which is all about exploring the fascinating world of plant intelligence and behavior. The book was fascinating. The conversation was even more fascinating. And as we swing into the season of planting our plants, planting our gardens, growing. I wanted to re-release this episode to remind us that it isn't just about growing. It's about so much more. Plants are so epic and amazing. And this episode really connects you to that sense of awe that we can have about them. So I hope you love it as much as I do.
Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Paco and Natalie, welcome to Growing Joy. I'm very excited and a little bit intimidated to have you guys here today.
Well, hi. Yeah.
Hi, nice to meet you.
You know, I was thinking about how I would introduce the both of you today, and I think I don't have the mental facilities to do it because you're both such brainiacs. You're so impressive. So do you each want to take a minute to introduce yourself and tell us how you are exploring this concept of plant intelligence?
Well, yeah, maybe I can get started with what is it that we do at the Minimal Intelligence Lab. I'm a professor of philosophy of science at the University of Murcia in Spain and director of the Minimal Intelligence Lab, which is a special kind of lab because it's a lab based in a philosophy department, not a plant science unit. And so people may think, what is it that you are able to do by studying plants scientifically from a philosophy department and not in a plant biology faculty or something, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say that, I guess, in a sense, we bring something fresh and special, which is precisely the fact that we are able to raise different questions than the questions that people might raise from a purely plant physiology perspective, so to speak.
What are those questions?
Well, think just if you think of plant electrophysiology or plant metabolism or anything related to the standard, the customary ways of approaching the study of plants, we take that for granted so we can get all those lessons straight from the plant biology classes. But we say, hey, hold on a sec, what is it that plants actually do that we cannot learn by simply looking at their molecular or the physiological underpinnings? And it has to do with their behavior. So if we want to understand plants, we need to observe and understand their behavior, how they behave. Mm-hmm. And whether their behavior is intelligent and what it takes for some behavior to be intelligent or not. So the very question of what makes some pattern of behavior intelligent in the first place is something that you need to ask, theoretically speaking, from the outside, from an outsider's perspective. Then you can try to bring that question into the lab and make the type of experiments that can throw light upon that question. But first of all, we need to understand what is it that we mean by intelligent behavior, be it a plant behavior, animal behavior, human behavior, any behavior whatsoever. What is it that makes it truly intelligent as opposed to just an adaptation?
Yeah, it's interesting too, because it sounds like you explore what we inherently understand as gardeners and houseplant parents, that there's so much more to our plants than just, you know, one of my biggest things is plants are so much more than, you know, interior decor. They're these living, breathing things that, you know, you establish a relationship with. And we understand that because we see it and interact with them on a daily basis. But there is so much that we don't understand because we're focusing so much on how do I effectively water the plant? How do I fertilize the plant? But, you know, there's so much more there. I can't wait to dive in. Yeah, I can't wait to dive in. Your book really blew me away. But before we dive in, your partner, Natalie. Natalie, can you introduce yourself? And, you know, you guys kind of co-wrote this book. You have a very interesting relationship. So can you kind of introduce yourself to us too?
So that kind of shift in perspective was something I had to go through because I'm a writer and illustrator, and my background is in zoology and history and philosophy of science. So I overlap with Paco in some ways on that, but I had to kind of, over the course of writing this book with Paco, I found my own view shifting and my eyes opening in terms of awareness of the capacities of plants and my own biases as well that had initially been there.
And with zoology, so that's studying animals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's
so
very interesting.
I was a natural scientist. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting though, because when you look at biophilia, you know, it's that concept of connecting with other living things. Yeah. And you realize like how interconnected plants and animals actually are. You know, I just got my first pet bird and I'm actually kind of looping this bird into this, you know, practice that I have with my plants, but also with birds, because it's all about just like engaging with living things, you know, that aren't inanimate.
That's a practice you have with your plants.
I wrote a whole book on how to engage with, how to use plants to cultivate more joy and calm in your life. So I have a morning routine with my plants. I look at my plants before I look at screens in the morning. So I spend time with my plants in the morning. And I think spending time with houseplants is the gateway to like spending time with yourself. You know, the more you connect with plants, you connect with nature. You are nature, you connect with yourself. It's a whole cycle we're in.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I wish we spend more time away from our screens, right?
Well, that's the beauty of this hobby too, you know, because we're coming from the hobbyist side of it. But that's the beauty of the hobby, is it gets you off your screens and it gets you, you know, in the dirt, in that physical, you know, experience.
Yeah. It's an interesting way of looking at it as well, because I think people are becoming increasingly aware that spending time in nature is good for you. But I don't think they necessarily think of it as spending more time with plants. They more think of, kind of getting away from the city and sort of going into nature, but not spending it with the other organisms in the nature so much.
Well, and it's interesting too, because as I dove into this and as, you know, I wrote my own book, so author to author, you know, as I started doing the research, it's interesting too that the world of science and the world of philosophy and the world of hobbyists, like we all need to kind of play with each other, because what I've realized is when I was writing my book about self-care, there were so many things that I knew, but the research that you look at is in very specific areas where there's money. So there's, you know, there's more nature-based research on what spending time in nature can do, because forest bathing in Japan, you know, forest bathing is a, you know, is a medicinal practice where doctors approve of it, you know? So there's research going into there. And then also I noticed there are a lot of studies with offices. So people are putting money into studying the effect of, you know, biophilic design in office spaces, not yet home, because I don't think there's, you know, money there. But it's interesting how the science and the intuition have to kind of play with each other and back each other up. Because, and that's really what you guys are doing too, to such another kind of more esoteric kind of degree of not necessarily proving how plants can be beneficial for humans, but just proving how plants are kind of as intelligent as us and actually, kind of more evolved than we are.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, to understand themselves for themselves and not in relation to us. Because
you just said it perfectly.
Yeah, we cannot help but thinking of plants as, in a sense, as resources, right? Then you end up thinking, hey, hold on a sec. I mean, if you were going to travel to some other planet and there was this form of life being rooted, being sessile, just by itself, without any pattern of coevolution with animals locomoting around or anything, how would you appreciate their smarts?
Yes.
Without relating it to the animal type of smarts that we are more familiar with, right?
So your book, Planta Sapiens, I read the whole thing. I feel like I need to go back and reread it because some of it is kind of dense. It is so freaking fascinating. Your section on anthropomorphilia and how, you know, this concept of maybe plants are steering the ship, even though we're steering the ship.
Sure.
Can you dive into that? Because I feel like this is the perfect jumping off point.
Yeah. Well, actually, think about it. We have a cartoon version of what evolution is about. Like, you know, say some form of life evolving or acquiring some type of adaptation for the good, of course, to pass their genes. And we forget that there is not such a thing as evolution, but you only find co-evolution. Because organisms can only evolve in the context of other organisms that they are interacting with.
Okay.
So there is not any form of evolution which is not co-evolving with other forms of life, right? And when you get there, you realize that in a sense, strictly speaking, no one is at the wheel, at the driving seat. Like, think of patterns of coevolution in between pollinators and flowers. Like, we always pay attention, we always focus our attention onto the pollinator, right? Oh, the pollinator is doing great. But if you think about how patterns of coevolution, how it pays off for both the flower, the plant, and the pollinator, the insect or whichever pollinator we are talking about, those patterns of coevolution, in a sense, imply that whatever is going on in the interaction is got to make sense from the perspective of both forms of life. So there's meaning-making on behalf of both the flower and of on behalf of the insect. In a sense, they are shaping each other, because otherwise the coevolution wouldn't work out unless there is a reciprocal shaping of each other, right? So in that sense, the same happens when you move on in this section you are referring to, when the pattern of coevolution is in between plants and human animals or human beings. Because in this case, we are far too used to ourselves to being at the driving seat that we forget that we are like the pollinator. We are just one more agent in a pattern of coevolution. So if we don't understand it in these terms, evolution simply wouldn't work, because we are just simply one more species in this whole entangled web, like Darwin like to say, right?
We're so obsessed with ourselves. But if you think about it, plants have been around so much more than us. Like, they've been around so much longer, and they'll be around so much longer than us, that who are we to like be so freaking obsessed with ourselves? Can you talk about, I just think, because we have, most people who listen to the show have houseplants. I giggled when I read your section in that chapter on how houseplants might have kind of steered the ship to develop this relationship with us. Can you talk to that, speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to visualize it unless we truly put ourselves in their shoes, right? So it's so easy to misunderstand it, to say simply, well, yeah, you know, it simply doesn't work from the perspective of them, plants, acquiring some sort of adaptation, right? You've got to think in a different, longer time scale. So agriculture has been, you know, for millennia, for thousands of years, we've been domesticating plants, right? So it's not simply this house plant sitting here, this potted plant next to me. It's the whole way the phenotype and genotype of plants have been shaped by our interaction with them, and reciprocally, how we are being shaped by interacting with them.
How much of our culture has been shaped by kind of the harvest cycle and the needs of the plants that we rely on in our lives, actually, in some ways?
Yeah, definitely. So that's part of the story, right? Like if you think of all these nested timescales, they are somehow reciprocally affecting each other on these loops, right? So it's like nested time scales and loops. And interaction is happening and influences are happening all the way from one way to the other, right? So just think of an example of how through agriculture we've been shaping them, right? By shaping them, I simply mean their phenotype. For example, think of a domesticated vine, climbing bean, for example, that one that has been domesticated through agriculture is one vine that has a shorter internode length. So in between nodes, the length is shorter, right? So this makes the plant more difficult to move around, to revolve. So plants grow by revolving in circles. Darwin called this circumnutation. So this pattern of circumnutation, like revolving in circles, is how plants grow, by shortening those distances out of the way we've been domesticating them. So we've been placing a pole next to the plant for centuries, for thousands of years. That's what we've done in agriculture to make it easier for us to pick fruit, to collect the yield, right? So by providing the pole to the plant, we've made it behave differently, because now it's shortened those distances and the plant doesn't revolve so dramatically as it would in the wild. So a wild plant will have to revolve in greater angles to try to search for a support, for a host tree, somewhere to twine around and grow, right? In domesticated plants, we are doing them away with that need, right? So in a sense, that's the way we're shaping them, to stay close to the pole, because there is no need to go out there and search for anything else. Now, this same rationale, how the way we've been handling them has made them be shaped in one way or another, this dwarfing or shortening of those distances and the resulting different way of patterns of growth that they exhibit, think about it the opposite way. How the way their interaction with us has changed the way we behave. So they are shaping us likewise, right?
They're shaping us to give them the pole.
Absolutely.
Right.
You can think of it in terms of the effect that we have on plants. You can think of it as we're exploiting them as resources, or we're using them for their beauty or whatever. You can also think about it as they have something that we want, and we have made their lives easier so they can invest more in it. You know, you give them nutrients, you keep them inside, you tend them. They can then invest more in flowers, in fruit, in all the things that we want. So actually, in some ways, it's like they have us to look after them, and then they can expand on the characteristics that we value.
Yeah. So the theory is like the plants have evolved to make themselves the most appealing to be brought indoors, because it's so much more comfortable for them to be living indoors where we're watering them and taking care of them instead of having to like fend for themselves in the wild.
Well, we have all become cozy, right? And yeah, that works for both of us. But we have to bear in mind that intelligence differs drastically. So different plants, different species, depending on the local conditions or the type of domestication or how, whether they are wild or domesticated and what type of domestication they've gone through, they will exhibit different smarts. So it's not that like, this is important, because it's not that plants are either stupid or smart. It's that they are intelligent or not to a different degree, or they are exhibiting different types of intelligence. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as humans.
The same as humans. Yeah. I mean, after reading your book, I'm like, man, there's more, we have more in common than I thought. So in the book, and speaking of that, you talk a lot about a plant's perspective. How do you see a plant's perspective? Can you share a little bit more about that?
Well, okay. So this is a really difficult exercise, right? This is not something you learn from the books. This is important because sometimes people think, okay, I can take this degree in plant science. I go through all these textbooks. I mean, I know what I need to know, and then I'm able to put myself in their shoes and acquire that perspective. This is something you cannot do unless you drop the book and sit next to the plant and watch it and observe it, right?
Tell me.
Yeah, and well, that's what we started doing here at MindLab. Actually, at the very beginning, we didn't even time-lapse. So now we time-lapse them. So we do two things, okay, to try to acquire this perspective. One is to observe their overt behavior, like through time-lapse photography, right? We take like a picture every minute, we assemble the footage, and then you can see, you know, a week of behavior in condensed into 2-3 minutes, right? That's certainly informative, and we couldn't study plant behavior without this tool, right? On the other hand, we also try to observe their behavior from the inside, which is through monitoring electrophysiological states, right? So we attach electrodes to the plant, and we can see what lights up. So as if you were going to the hospital to have a brain scan.
Stress test,
right?
Yeah.
The very same thing is we are monitoring their electrophysiological activity. And then we try to see how that correlates with the overt behavior that we can observe through time-lapse photography. But before you do those two things, what I was meaning to say is that first you sit and simply observe not just the plant, but actually what is surrounding the plant. So what the plant cares about. So the sun is setting right now here in Murcia. Okay, how long does it take? What's happening to the light? How things are, you know, quieting down? So all these features or all these regularities that go round the clock, like day-night cycles, seasons, all these cycles, all this regular information, we are all sensitive to that type of information, mm-hmm. right? Any form of life whatsoever, right? On planet Earth, we have evolved to be sensitive to those features because we are very, very sensitive to that information because it's relevant to our doings, right? Like night comes, day, temperature, humidity drops, peaks. So all that information is highly important to keep track of. So if you sit next to the plant, you might be seeing, for example, a legume, the climbing bean. The legume is folding its leaves. This is called a nyctinasty, right? It's folding its leaves 1 hour prior to the sun setting. Mm-hmm. Okay, rather than simply go on the time-lapse footage and watch it speed up, no, let's sit back and relax and do it at plant space. So sit there and see, actually, you can see this to the naked eye. So to the naked eye, if you are careful or patient enough, you can sit for an hour and see how they are folding their leaves. Because by accelerating it through time-lapse photography, we might be missing something that relates to the appreciation of the effort and the time needed for that behavior to take place. So when we started observing plants to try to put ourselves in their shoes, the first point was to say, hey, let's observe them, not by relying or resorting to some technology to speed them up, but by slowing ourselves down. And this is important because unless you do that, you're going to miss the real-time scaling which their behavior operates.
And that's one of the key shifts that needs to happen in the book, that we talk about in the book, that needs to happen is shifting our awareness of the fact that other organisms, the intelligence of other organisms is very much within their own ecological contexts. So we can't have a blanket view of what intelligence is. Intelligence evolved to suit an organism and allow it to do well in its environment. And that's very different for every single organism. So plants have a very different way of operating to us, and therefore the types of intelligence they need are very different, and that the types of perception that they have, the way they see the world, is incredibly different. So one of the kind of imaginative shifts that we need to make in order to be able to understand them better is trying to really get out of our own frameworks of what's important, what's relevant in the environment, and try and think what's going to be relevant to a plant.
Oh my gosh.
What is it that they care about, right? What is it that they care about?
Well, and you know what's so interesting that I think I just listening to the two of you talk had this weird aha moment is I think the solution for so many issues in the world right now is reconnecting with nature. Mm-hmm. Like if we could all just go back to what was working before we messed everything up, right? Like if we could all just slow down, right, Paco? Like that's what you just kept saying. We have to slow down to listen to the plants. Also, I think like, you know, our earth, like we need to take care of the earth. We need to deal with global warming. We need to deal with our overstimulation and burnout, all this stuff. I think nature's the answer. Plants are the most in tune with nature because they have like the earth. Like you mentioned, you know, how plants are so sensitive to the sun cycles and you know, all of that. So they have a way to communicate and observe the earth and nature, because they are nature, but like they get to observe these natural rhythms that we have become so farther disconnected from with a sensitivity that we lack. And that's amazing, right? So they're so intelligent in their own way that this bean knows to start closing its leaves before the sun sets. And then it's our job to try and observe the plant to then put ourselves in its shoes to be able to become that more hypersensitive. Like we don't have that sensitivity that these plants have to sync up with these natural cycles and to become more in tune with the earth and what it needs.
Well, isn't it amazing? I mean, this reconnecting, think of what we are doing nowadays. Instead of doing that exercise of slowing down, we go to the pharmacy and buy melatonin tablets, right?
Yeah.
Right? So, well, the example of the legume that they fold their leaves 1 hour ahead of time, right? It's not just that they are folding their leaves, it's that they are biosynthesizing their own cytomelatonin. That's something we recount in the book, right? So they synthesize their own melatonin. We are so stubborn that we think that melatonin is an animal thing, and we just couldn't picture plants synthesizing their own melatonin. To the point that when this was discovered 25 years ago, scientists decided that they required the prefix phyto, so they couldn't be synthesizing melatonin. It had to be phytomelatonin to distinguish it from the animal real melatonin, right? Mm-hmm. And in the end, it's the same molecule, and we don't get it. So in the end, we don't get it. We force them to use the prefix phyto because that's to distinguish it from the real melatonin, which is ours. And they end up biosynthesizing it naturally to go to bed, and we end up going to the pharmacy because we are, you know, in this crazy lifestyle that we are carrying out, right?
Yeah.
And then you swallow the synthetic melatonin to put you back in track with the planetary cycles when plants are doing it the natural way.
But if you think about it, you know, that bean is starting to preparing to close its leaves before the sun sets, and the humans, we won't, you know, metaphorically close our leaves. We'll go, I will work until 10 p.m. and then expect myself to go right to bed and fall asleep. Mm-hmm. And that's where I take the melatonin instead of having my hour to close my leaves of, you know, turning off my screens, having a cup of tea, stop watching TV. And like, once again, the answers are all in freaking nature. So I have to bring up, you are obsessed with vining plants, obviously. You write about specifically vining plants in your book more than any other plant.
It's a little obsession.
Why the vining plants so much?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question because vines, climbing beans in this case, or any other vine, they are really special, you know? I mean, for one thing, think about this pattern we said of leaf folding an hour ahead of sunset, right? That's anticipatory behavior, right? And if there is a type of plants that need to exploit anticipatory behavior, this is climbers. And the reason is that they found this trade-off in evolution, which is either you devote all your resources to building up a robust, solid stump to grow from, right? The base of the trunk. Or you don't, and you rely on somebody else's strength, like the host tree you twine around, right? So that means that I'm going to grow fast, but weak. And that also means that I cannot afford to fail. If I'm reaching out for a target, if I have to grow in a goal-directed manner to reach the target, I need to do so in a way which I don't miss. Because if I miss my target, I might not have a second chance. So I better do well. So plants, climbers have evolved really smart adaptations. You know, they sniff out those host trees because they need to make sure they have the, for example, if it's a parasitic plant, those that cannot even photosynthesize, they really need, you know, think of the dodder in the US. So those plants cannot do their own food stuff out of photosynthesis, right? So if they are targeting a host plant to drill their stem and suck up their sugars, they cannot afford missing because by the time they say, oops, I missed it, I was growing in the wrong direction, I'm going to try again. By the time you try again to a second direction, second target, it's too late. You are dead meat, right?
You're dead, yeah.
Do you want to remind us some of the ways they find their hosts?
Yeah, actually, when we say that they are sniffing them out, we mean it. This is no metaphor, right? So they are sensing those chemicals, those volatiles that the host tree or the host plant is emitting. They can tell gradients of ratio of different light, parts of the light spectrum. So for example, the ratio of red to far red light, because plants are absorbing red and are reflecting far red. The same goes with blue and green. So those ratios, the amount of red to far red or the amount of blue to green is providing the climber with really, really rich information as to who is around. So I know there is more guys around here because the ratio is changing. As I grow towards this area, there is more red or blue being absorbed. There are guys over here or the chemicals they are emitting. So all this information is so valuable. But the important thing is that they have to do it ahead of time. So in a sense, they have to predict the future. They have to anticipate, right? So when people say that plants are, in a sense, stupid because they are rooted, this is a quote from a fellow philosopher we use in the book. And we say, you know, quoting from this person, we say, yeah, they say, well, you know, plants being rooted, they can afford to be stupid. But we animals on the moving business, we are up and down here and there. We cannot afford to be stupid. It's the other way around. It's like, hey, if you are sessile, if you are rooted, how smart you've got to be to keep passing the genes despite being rooted.
Interesting.
In this case, anticipatory behavior is a must. You cannot afford to miss.
So the argument is that plants are smarter because they've had to overcome having roots and adapting. So they're actually, that's what you're saying, right? That they're more evolved because they're successful with roots.
I would say, I see what you mean. But I could say not that they are smarter because we would be falling prey of the same mistake we've done when comparing animals, non-human animals to us. Like, you know, this great chain of being. Like we say, hey, we are here at the top. And this vertical hierarchical arrangement, like the smarter, then the medium, then the lowest. And then we have this idea of who is the real smart guys in the tree of life and the others trying to reach or to approach to their smarts. And I would avoid comparisons.
Okay.
It's easier to say. So rather than more or less smart, I could say exhibiting this type of smart or this type of behavior, because we have different problems. So it's not that we are more or less intelligent. It's that because we have different problems, we are encountering different situations in life, precisely because the way we behave, we locomote, we move around, we do this, we do that. We cannot photosynthesize our own food stuff. We have to go shopping. So because on my way to the shop to buy my dinner, I might get run over by a car. I have different problems from plan. So different problems means different solutions. So they came up with a different set of solutions. So their toolkit is different, neither better nor worse, simply different.
Uh-huh.
It's more of a counter argument to the idea that because they're sessile, they must be stupid. It's not that they're smarter than us. It's more actually we would predict they would be intelligent because they cannot afford to mess up. I can't afford not to be there, but we should accept that they are intelligent because it doesn't make sense if they're not. You know, how do they survive if not?
They wouldn't be here otherwise, put it that way. Yeah.
Definitely.
So again, going back to why climbers or why vines. So that was one idea, right? But there is another important point, which is already backing in the writings of Darwin, right? You see the tribute we pay to Darwin throughout the book.
Yes, definitely.
And here, Darwin, if you see, he was able to observe all these behaviors to the naked eye, right?
Yeah.
And that's something I emphasize in my classes too, with students, because I say, hey, don't get overexcited with technology. Because people think, okay, just by having the best technology we can have today, you just think that you, by doing that, you already have the answers. Like, okay, yeah, sure, you have this gadget. Oh, what a great toy I got for Christmas. I'm going to place it. Sure. And the best toy is the trained eye, the way you are able definitely. To train your mind. And that doesn't come with gadgets or with high tech. That comes with the perspective and the way you educate yourself or train yourself into that perspective. And with climbers, with vines, in a sense, it's easier to do because their behavior is more conspicuous to the eye. So it's easier to spot the naked eye. Other plants, their time scale, their behavior unfolds in longer time scales. But literally, if I'm in Majatic, actually, you're right here on Majatic on top of this room is where I started observing these climbing beings before setting up the lab at the uni. So I could sit there with a climbing being simply to watch it. And literally, if I was sitting there for 2 hours or 3 hours, which again is a great mindfulness exercise. Just sit there and watch your climbing beam. If you do so, you will realize that you don't even need time-lapse footage. You do see to the naked eye. So the time scale in which their behavior unfolds is in a way closer. We think they grow so slowly that we cannot possibly observe their behavior. No, no, they are slow, but they are faster than many people think.
Species.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's funny. In my book, I beg people to take 5 minutes, 5 minutes with your plants. No screens, uninterrupted time with your plants. And you're saying 3 hours. You're the 2.0 version. You know, once you master take five with plants, take 3 hours with plants. Okay. So we talked a lot about plant intelligence. I'm curious about plants and their feelings because, you know, as houseplant parents, specifically gardeners, we talk to our plants, we care them, we like establish this paternal bond with our plants, and we have these feelings towards our plants. And I think, you know, you've seen these different studies of like the tomato plants in school, and a group of the kids are yelling at one of the plants and a group of the kids are speaking kindly to the other plant. And, you know, there's all of this interesting conversation about whether they feel or not, and whether they can feel the nurturing things that, you know, the nurturing that we're giving them. So what is your take on that?
Yeah. Well, one thing is feeling is a dangerous word, right? The term itself, because it's really heavily loaded, right? So it's
subjective.
So we should be careful. I'm not against using that term, but with some caveats, right? So that we make sure we understand what we are talking about. So one thing is for sure, plants sense their surroundings. That's for sure, right? And they have a panoply of sensors. They have all sorts of ways to sense many, many different environmental parameters, like, you know, both biotic and abiotic. So they can sense neighbors, stress of many sources, electromagnetic fields, of course, the gravity pool, light, of course, many different... So all sorts of things they are sensing all day long, nonstop. So they are monitoring their surroundings round the clock. Going back to the idea of being sessile, how could they survive without constantly monitoring their surroundings to take anticipatory action when the time is needed, right? So that one thing is to understand that they do sense their surroundings. And a different issue is to say that they feel in a way that brings them closer to what we mean by humans' feelings, right? So take the idea of suffering. When people say, do plants suffer? Well, we know certainly that plants can be stressed, and they are stressed. Hydric stress, if you don't water them, salinity, okay? Salinity, salt can be a great source of stress for life, right? So we know there is all forms of stress out there, right? Now, so one risk in discussing the feelings of plants is that we are anthropomorphizing what we mean by it in a way that, oh, you are looking at your potted plant in your room or in your backyard or whatever, and then you have an idea of what is it that they, in a sense, they should be feeling from your perspective.
Okay.
And then we need to forget about ourselves. That's another good exercise. To forget about ourselves and to think, if humans weren't around at all, what is it that they would be caring about?
Like the comparison of what is it like to be a plant and what the plant sensed. You've got to think about it in terms of what is it useful for plants to feel? What is it useful for humans to feel? We are sociable animals that are wired to empathize and create community and to have theory of mind. Is that any evolutionary value to a plant?
Absolutely.
plants' feelings in terms of the human feelings have no real relevance to a plant. It would not serve any function. But do they have experience of suffering and negative subjective experiences? Probably. We are able to empathize with them because we are geared to empathize with things we care about, and we anthropomorphize them. So in some ways, it's not a bad, you know, if you want to care for your houseplants, it's probably not a bad thing to kind of imagine that they have human feelings. But in terms of if we're trying to really understand what plants experience and how plants operate, we have to really think what kind of subjective experiences are going to be of value to a plant. Apparently emotions are not one of them.
Yeah. Well, actually, Natalie's saying is the perfect example of a potential misunderstanding in this context.
Yeah, totally.
Think of classical music versus some other type of music. Some people think, oh, if you play this sort of music or this other sort of music to the plant, we are projecting the way we enjoy that music, and we assume that plants will likewise enjoy it or not in the same way we do, right? And the fact that that wouldn't make any evolutionary sense doesn't mean that there is no mechanosensory perception. So, of course, the surface of the plant body is full of sensors sensitive to that sort of mechanical stimulation, so the one coming from vibrations. So we are not doing away with the idea that plants can, in principle, be sensing that acoustic information surrounding their environment, whatever noises or sounds or whatever is happening at home, right? That's certainly the case. They are very sensitive to that sort of mechanical stimulation. It's just a matter of categorizing it differently. Their categories don't need to match our categories, as in classical music versus hard rock or whatever.
Yeah.
See what I...
Well, it's interesting too, because it sounds like, yes, plants feel, but they don't feel the way that we feel. So we feel love to our plants, right? Like I feel bonded and I get my little bonding hormone. What is it? Not serotonin.
Oxytocin.
Oxytocin.
Yeah. I get my little oxytocin burst when I water my plants and talk to them. The plants are going to sense and feel my being around them, my watering, whatever, but they're not going to be feeling love towards me the way I feel, because I'm assuming plants don't make oxytocin. Yeah. But so it's that there's feelings at play for both sides, but they're different. And we have to decenter ourselves from the approach to trying to understand them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. Yeah. Still, in the context of what Natalie said before, it would make sense, this thing you just said, if we, instead of using plant and the interaction with the human, say plant and the interaction with the pollinator. Evolutionarily speaking, that pattern of interaction does make sense to say, hey, the plant might be feeling something as it's interacting with the pollinator, because that pattern of coevolution has been sculpted throughout evolutionary time.
Yeah.
So they're having... That makes sense, evolutionarily speaking.
Totally. That's so, oh my gosh, this is wild. I am dying right now because we have a hard out in 10 minutes. I could sit and chat with you guys for so much longer. We'll definitely have to have you back on the show. But one thing that I found fascinating that I wanted to talk to you about, which I think is an interesting way to wrap, is that we actually both opened our books with plant blindness. That was the first chapter of my book, because I very much experienced plant blindness as living in New York City, never noticed the trees on my street, never noticed the plants in the stores, grew up with, you know, plants that I never noticed in a house. And then all of a sudden, when I started caring for plants, I was like staring in awe at the trees on my street and noticing the rogue morning glory. Like, it was an awakening in me. Like, truly. You speak, you know, you also share that, but kind of more through a lens of science and like the great chain of being. Can you speak to plant blindness a little bit?
Well, yeah. Well, it's great to hear that we both opened up with blindness. I mean, that cannot be a coincidence. There's got to be something there, right? I think that blindness sense goes way beyond plant blindness. So we are blind to so many things, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And to me, what's really revealing about blindness is what it implies about what we mean by seeing, by perceiving the surroundings.
Ooh,
because we have,
okay.
Well, we have this cartoonish understanding of seeing as something like, okay, something gets into my retina and then I process that image with my visual cortex as if it was something static, like I cannot do anything about it. Information comes into my eye and then boop, pops up the image in my brain, right? And I think what's revealing is that seeing or perceiving the surroundings has to do with the expectations we bring about. So we don't see what we are not expecting to see. right? Mm-hmm. So precisely because we can only see what we expect to see, this is a question that relates to the way we have been educated, both in school and in the more generally, right? So, and more generally again, doesn't it happen to you when you go to another city visiting and you see things with a fresh eye? Everything is revealing, is sexy, is appealing. And then you go back to your own city and you go, oh, I have these amazing things in my city and I never see them. I'm blind to my city because it's far too familiar.
Oh, yeah.
Far too close.
I can speak to that for New York City, yeah, for sure.
I don't see the mountains next to Murcia and I go some other city and I cannot help to say, oh, shit, I have to hike that mountain. I have to go there. And I don't see that when I'm far too close. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, we are so close to plants because we are surrounded by them. In a sense, or naturally speaking, evolutionarily speaking, that we tend to think of them as this background greenery that we speak of in the book, right? It's, okay, it's just sitting there. We don't pay attention to it, right?
Yeah.
So definitely with...
Is that experience you get when you're used to the kind of foliage you get in your where you live, you know, all the shapes of the leaves, the colors, the textures, and then you go somewhere completely different, like the tropics or Asia or somewhere very different from like where one lives, and the kind of the composite effect of all the difference in the species around you is actually quite shocking. You can't distinguish them very well. You haven't got your eye in, but you also notice them a lot more because the texture of the surrounding plant life feels so different.
Natalie, coming from a zoology background, when I was learning about plant blindness, it was interesting also all of these studies that show that humans recognize animals as living things more than plants. What was that like for you diving into the other side of this? Coming from the animal side.
So I was increasingly aware of my own biases as well. I'd always gone to commune with trees and things like that, but I'd never really gone into plant sciences very much because I just had this prejudice that they were just less interesting to me than animals. And so it was very eye-opening to have to shift my perspective and really explore my own plant blindness.
Yeah. Well, remember the example we recount in the book about, you know, students on campus. They come into classes every morning for years, undergrads 4 years, and they couldn't believe it when you tell them, look, you, every morning when you walk from the bus stop to class, you walk through these, you know, carefully curated gardens with hundreds of species. Mm-hmm. You ask them, all of them, say, hey, how many different species you reckon there are around campus? It's, you know, 10, 20 maybe. When you tell them there are over 500 different species, they walk by every single morning for the last 4 years. What was I? I mean, in my own bubble, right?
We are in our own bubble. Yeah, I think too, it's interesting because I grew up in New York, so I have been lucky to experience four seasons and we get great fall foliage, right? But growing up, that was just so normal to me. Like it was just part of life. And, you know, once a year, there were piles of brown leaves and you jump in them and it was fun and then you moved on. The way that people lose their shit over fall foliage in New York and the Northeast, people come from all over the world to come see the leaves turn brown here. And it's interesting as an adult now because my husband and I have, you know, our anniversary trip, we went around the Northeast looking at all the beautiful foliage everywhere. But it is so interesting of like, it's also kind of, it's this concept of figuring out what you take for granted and finding newfound appreciation for it. And I think your book, you know, as we kind of have to wrap up, your book is a beautiful opportunity for people to take this relationship with plants that we have to the next level, because your book really does make us question. It made me question so much about what I've assumed. And I think this conversation too, like you are continually pushing me to be like, okay, but take yourself out of this. You know, my book and my career is how do we use plants to feel better as humans? I feel like your book and your career is how do we get out of our own egocentric human ways to ask ourselves the bigger questions? And, you know, I think in general, just we've scratched the surface of this topic in this conversation, but we've scratched the surface of the opportunity for unbelievable gratitude for plants and awe of gratitude for plants and nature and how freaking amazing they are.
It is, absolutely. I wish we learned something, right? Out of this appreciation, we learn what to do about it because it's just like,
absolutely.
That's the next stage, do something about it.
Yes, that's the next step. So Paco, Natalie, this was so fun. I'd love to have you back on the show because I feel like we could take one chapter in your book and have an hour conversation, let alone trying to like talk about the whole concept of plant intelligence in, you know, 50 minutes. But where can everyone find you and find your book so that they can continue learning and having their mind's horizon expanded?
Natalie's webpage is way better than mine. I have one of these, you know, boring academic pages.
Okay.
So the book itself, I think in Natalie's webpage is way nicer. If people want to dive in the MINT lab, the Minimal Intelligence Lab, to see what is it that we do at the lab and the type of experiments, we scientific experiments we do to unearth plant intelligence, they could go to visit my site, which is the MINT lab. They can Google it up, MINT lab, Minimal Intelligence Lab.
I can also find the book on Amazon as well, and it's coming out in the States in March as well.
Amazing.
It's going to be out soon.
Fabulous. We'll link to everything in the show notes as well, so people can go check out MINT. Pago, I think we should definitely just have you back for an episode on MINT, because the studies that you dive into on your book are like so wild. Yes, I can't recommend this book enough, just to be completely humbled as a plant parent of realizing how much you don't really know or understand about your amazing plant.
Well, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
Okay, plant friends, the book Plantus Sapiens is linked in the show notes, as is Professor Calvo and Natalie's information. If this episode made you look at plants a little differently, if this episode tapped you into your sense of awe, please share it with a fellow plant friend who probably would love this philosophical conversation as well. It's such a fun conversation that doesn't have to do with the how-to of gardening. It's really like zooming out and thinking about plants from a larger perspective. And I just thought it was so fun. And of course, come tell me what you thought of it, whether it's in an email or over at Instagram at Growing Joy with Maria. I'm always here for you. And until next time, keep slowing down, keep noticing nature, keep tapping into awe, and of course, keep growing joy.
Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.